Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 37 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Keeping the Wild. Actually, isn't that 38 now?
Yes, it is, actually. The one that just came out, yes.
So first off, thank you for your work. And second, thank you for being on the program. And third, I was going to ask you to talk about saving large places. But before we do that, let's talk about for just a minute about Book 38 and then transition into saving large places.
Okay. Well, the latest book is in a collection. I'm just the editor. I just have one chapter in it. But it's called Protecting the Wild, Parks and Wilderness, the Foundation for Conservation. And the reason we produced this book was, and we'll probably get into this in more detail here, is that there has been an attack on the concept of parks and wilderness value for conservation. Some saying that it's an out-of-date concept in today's world, others saying that it's totally ineffective at even the goal of conservation. And so what we sought to do was collect essays from people knowledgeable about their particular part of the world and have them give examples of where large conservation areas like parks and wildlands preserves do work or work, and this is an important point, work better than the alternatives that are being proposed. And this, we got people from writing from about Asia, about Africa, about Europe, about South America, Australia, and of course North America as well. But we tried to make it a representation from the entire world and show that one, two things. One, that the idea of parks is a concept that has been perpetuated around the world, in part, we would argue, because it is effective at accomplishing a lot of conservation goals. And the second thing to say about that is it is a way of helping to preserve biodiversity and ecosystem function that works better in most cases than any other alternative that's been tried around the world. And we have essays from people who can show comparisons. For example, in the Amazon basin, there are strictly protected areas, our traditional parks kind of thing. And then there are what are more loosely defined as sustainable development areas, where the concept is we're going to have people in here exploiting the land, but they're still going to protect and try to preserve biodiversity. And the amount of deforestation that has happened in the sustainable forestry areas with negative impacts on the biodiversity is far higher than in the strictly protected areas. The critics would say the strictly protected areas, still some of them have some logging or whatever, which is true, but it is significantly reduced compared to any other alternative. So that was what the book is about. And we have some really stellar authors from around the world, well-known people. We have a foreword by John Terborg, an essay by Reed Knotts and a bunch of other conservation biologists about how conservation, thinking boldly about conservation. We have an essay by Jane Goodall, Brock Evans, and who's worked many years here in North America on wildlands, and so forth. I could go down the list. It would take me all day to read everybody, but we have a really an amazing group of authors, and they are very knowledgeable about their particular areas of expertise.
Okay, so the next question I'm going to ask you, I think, is the stupidest and most embarrassing question I've ever asked any interview subject. And it's embarrassing and stupid because the answer seems so self-evident to me. But why is it necessary or beneficial to protect large areas of land or sea for habitat for non-humans? And I'm only asking this question because this is how absurd our public discourse has gotten, that we actually have to defend this. But so there we go. I'm asking this ridiculous question.
Well, I hope I can answer it adequately, but I can rely on several lines of reasoning. One is, I believe this is probably the most important one. We have an ethical responsibility to not prematurely eliminate many life forms on Earth. Now, the arguments of those who are opposing parks and conservation often say, well, evolution is happening, and in fact, when species go extinct, we have new species coming about. I just read an article this weekend by somebody saying, well, you know, after the dinosaurs died out, we had this rapid generation of new and evolution of new species. And that's all true, but I could say, well, you know, if we went and stood everybody up in a line and then mowed them down with machine guns around the world or whatever, and reduce the population, we'd, of course, open up lots of terrain and territory for people to, younger and newly born people to exploit. But we would find that kind of approach unethical, to say the least. So prematurely condemning species to extinction when it's preventable, or we could prevent it, is to me a morally bankrupt position to have. So that's the sort of the ethical part of it. Then I can get to more practical reasons in that functioning ecosystems, from just a purely selfish motivation, functioning ecosystems with their full suite of species are able to provide for more stable environments for humans. It is part of the argument, in fact, that some of those advocating for not having parks and conservation areas will argue. They'll say, well, you know, we have to argue that protecting the forest is good for watersheds and therefore clean water, which of course it is. However, I think what we want to do is expand our area of what and who we think is important to consider in our decisions. And it is sort of this ethical evolution, you might say, just as over time we came to the conclusion that slavery was an abomination and that we shouldn't have slaves anymore. And then we took it a little step further and said that you couldn't exploit workers badly, so you had to have set hours and set pay. We expanded it further and said that we're not going to allow at least some animals to be abused. We're very selective about which animals, but it's a step forward in that we've expanded the circle of creatures and individuals that are considered worthy of consideration by us and how we affect them. So I would argue that the reason we need these things is, a practical reason, because it benefits us in some ways. It also protected areas, I might add, strictly protected areas are a control in the sense of when you do science, one of the arguments you always have or should have in your experiment is have an area that you're not manipulating or part of the experiment that is left untouched. And then you can tell what you are manipulating, how it's changed things. So our strictly protected parks and wildlands become a place where we can measure how well things like so-called sustainable development is working and whether it is working in the long run. And it gives us a place to make comparisons from. And without that place of comparisons, then one is lost and can't really know how well or how poorly the sustainable development paradigm works.
Which is not well. Yes.
I would say that. And then, of course, those who want to exploit things, as we were saying earlier, a lot of this new position is being driven by people who identify themselves as environmentalists in the debate, but they are arguing and articulating things that the more, we can say, development-oriented industries support. And, of course, if you're an industry that wants to exploit things, you don't want people to know how you're affecting things. So you don't want clean air, for example, because if you have clean air someplace or clean water, then people are going to be able to say, well, if my water isn't clean anymore, you're responsible. And so when we don't have a control, it's easy for people to get used to a degraded landscape and environment because they're not going to have anything they know better from.
So what are – lately there has been this sort of attack on – like I live in Del Norte County, which is the far northwest county of California, and it's about the politics. I often sort of say that this is Mississippi on the north coast in that it's extremely right-wing, and a lot of this county is in park, which is wonderful. But the arguments against the park are almost exclusively in this county. Well, we can't cut the trees and we can't ride our ORVs off in the forest. And so they're not put in the guise of neo-environmentalism. They are instead just strict so-called wise use or anti-environmental rhetoric. But lately, there has been an attack on parks, on the notion of protecting large wild spaces that has come, as you said, by people calling themselves environmentalists. And before I actually ask you what their argument is, I want to just mention, and maybe we can come back to this or not, as you wish, that one of the things that this culture is really, really good at is co-opting movements for sanity and sustainability and justice into serving, using the rhetoric and turning them back around. And in fact, I mentioned before we started recording that I'm thinking about doing a book with Gail Dines about how, and some other people, about how neoliberalism has destroyed a lot of radical movements by taking, like third wave feminism has really destroyed a lot of feminism, and neo-environmentalism is attempting to destroy a lot of environmentalism. And so this is sort of a pattern. So having said all that, and we can go there or not, having said all that, what is the neo-environmentalist argument against saving large places?
Well, you know, one is the argument that they are being pragmatic, that human society is spreading across the globe because of our increasing population, and there's a certain willingness to say that that's inevitable, which, of course, I would say, well, we don't have to inevitably keep growing our population, but they accept that is the future, and as a result, humans will need to exploit more of the Earth's surface to sustain themselves. That's the first thing. So they think they're being pragmatic, saying that, well, since we're going to be exploiting things anyway, let's try to make it somewhat benign so that the impacts are somewhat lessened. And so that's the one part of the argument. I think a second part of the argument in some parts of the world, and particularly I don't like to use the term third world, but in parts of the world that where there's a lot more poverty, the argument is that protected areas come at the expense of poor people, that the most impoverished people are the ones that suffer the most because they aspire to a lifestyle that even you know, poor people, you could say homeless people in the United States, many of them have more access to food and so forth than a lot of people in some of these poorer countries around the world. And that's certainly true. And so their argument is that it's not fair to have these people disenfranchised and have their ability to exploit the world around them limited for the sake of non-human world or for the benefit of people who may not live in that area. I mean, it's not an very similar argument that you hear all around even North America, as well off as we are, constant, particularly in rural counties around the western United States, which is where I'm most familiar with, there's always the argument that we can't exploit the local resources, so we're poor, and it's you people in the cities that are telling us, who are richer, that we can't cut down the trees or graze the land or drill for oil and gas and so forth, when that is a way we could increase our economic ability. And a third way that the argument goes is that in the more harsher or radical of these folks will say that parks don't work and they are failing to conserve wildlife and biodiversity. And what you see that I want to answer that one right away, which is that argument is only true where we do not have enough land or ocean set aside for the full complement of species to be able to sustain a reasonable population and for processes that are critical to the maintenance of the ecosystem. A processes would be like predation, wildfires, floods. These natural events help to sustain a lot of ecosystems. So we need areas that are large enough. And where we have those, the protected areas work very well. I'm real familiar with Alaska, for example. I've spent many, many summers up there. I worked up there as a park ranger and so forth. And I can tell you that the parks up there and our preserves are all have their full complement of species that weren't wiped out 100 years ago anyway. And in many cases, some of those species like muskoxen have been reintroduced. And they're doing well. So what we see is where we have those kinds of large protected areas, we do have able to sustain the wildlife. And then we can look to another area like Yellowstone Park, which is another area I know very well. And Yellowstone itself is not large enough over the long haul probably to sustain all its ecosystem processes well. However, it is fortunately embedded into this larger ecosystem, people refer to it as the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, where because of that surrounding land, typically national forest wilderness areas, which are managed largely for natural processes, that greatly expands the sort of footprint, you might say, of Yellowstone. And thus far, I can show you that compared to any of the other public lands and or private lands that you might have in Idaho, Wyoming, or Montana, the Yellowstone Park and its surrounding wilderness areas are more intact ecologically than any of the so-called sustainable use areas. And you must remember that the national forests, the Bureau of Land Management lands, and so forth, are legally mandated to be managed for sustainable uses. And yet, it's very clear if you look at any of those lands and compare them to fully protected areas like Yellowstone, that they're not holding up as well as Yellowstone is. Even though there are millions of people go through Yellowstone every year, we have far fewer species surviving well and intact in the surrounding exploited landscape compared to in Yellowstone and its surrounding wilderness areas.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that argues for, where parks are not working up to their full potential, you can usually find it's due to the fact that they're either too small, too isolated, and are or just grossly mismanaged in the case of some, particularly in other parts of the world. But where there is intact protection, where there are either large protected areas connected by to other large areas, we find that these protected areas do their job very well, and they may not ultimately work in the long run if human population keeps on increasing the way it is, but they're going to be the place where things last the longest and give us the greatest opportunity to maybe come to our senses and change our ways, and we'll have something left that we can turn to as a safety valve, and hopefully still have a lot of animals and ecological processes intact that we can learn from.
The reason that I was saying that my question was embarrassing and stupid is that I find it ridiculous that we even have to defend the notion that species need habitat. I mean, it just seems so obvious to me that, I mean, if you cut down a forest, you have destroyed the habitat for the forest creatures. And if you, like right now on the Front Range of Colorado, there is some wonderful activists are fighting desperately to try to save one of the largest remaining prairie dog villages in the Front Range of Colorado, because they're going to build the largest mall in the United States on that site. And I mean, obviously, if there's a mall and parking lot, this is not good habitat for prairie dogs, as opposed to prairie, which is. And it's and all the creatures who rely on prairie dogs. And it just, I can't get over how, obviously in my work, I write about discourse a lot, because even though I've written 20 some books, I can't get over how ridiculous so much of our discourse is around this, that yes, a creature needs habitat. And if you exploit them, I mean, if you and I are neighbors and I continue to steal from you, and I continue to steal from you a lot, then that's probably not going to, you're not going to be as well off as if I weren't stealing from you. It seems pretty clear to me.
Right, right. Well, that, again, just to, to agree with you is, yes, species do need habitat, and the habitat that we provide them in many cases, unfortunately, is not necessarily the best habitat that's ideal for them. So they're at a disadvantage to begin with, and that is why I think it's critical to have strictly protected areas as a paradigm. That doesn't mean that we don't try to improve how you do things like grazing or logging, but I think anybody who tells me that logging, for example, or grazing is improving the ecosystem and for all biodiversity is, they just can't be serious. You can't be taking the bulk of the wood out of the forest ecosystem and saying that isn't harming the ecosystem, because there's a lot of things that depend on that wood. Even the dead trees, when they die, are important in many cases for ecosystems. And it's the same if you have an exotic animal like a cow grazing out on the prairie. Well, the grass that's going into that cow is not grass that's going into grasshoppers or prairie dogs or any of the other wildlife that's out there. And the flowers that are being eaten up are not there for butterflies and bees to access. So it just seems almost ridiculous to argue that that these things are a benefit in the long run. The best we can do is say that we recognize that this is what I wish people would say, we recognize that these things have an impact, and we should be trying to limit them to the smallest footprint necessary to provide for, you know, some basic human needs. And one would hope that what the definition of basic is, needs, gets a lot of discussion, because, of course, some people would say that, you know, we all need, you know, large houses and three cars and so forth. And I think a more reasonable approach would be, you know, that you're not hungry and some other things like that. But I think one of the problems with the, you know, what's called the sustainable development or community-based conservation, there are various terms and that can be used, is that there are a number of things that happen. One, a lot of these areas that we have set aside, whether for sustainable development or sustained yield or whatever the term is, are finite in size and finite in what reasonably can be removed before you have a significant impact on how that ecosystem functions. And one of the problems is, of course, is that when you're exploiting natural areas to provide income for local people, is that over time, often the population of the local population increases. And so you're spreading the same finite amount of resources and maybe income among more and more people, which is, you know, most people don't find acceptable. So they pressure for, of course, additional exploitation, whether it's fishing, you know, fishing on the ocean, or whether it's logging trees in the forest, or shooting, like in Africa, you know, they might have wildlife that's killed by big game hunters, and they pay a fee to kill that wildlife, and it's spread among the people nearby. In theory, that sounds good, but it hasn't worked nearly as well. It may seem to work at first when it's first set up, but over time, because of population growth and expectations, people want usually more over time. And so what you have is, if you keep the kill of big game in a preserve in Africa steady, each person over time gets a declining income. And the other thing that goes against that is we humans are very oriented towards immediate gratification. And there's lots of economic studies that show this. If I say to you, I'll give you $1,000 today, but if you wait 10 years, I'll give you $10,000. Most people say, well, give me $1,000 today. And that is the same thing that goes on with these resources, where you can say to them, well, look, if we only kill so many, I don't know, elephants or whatever it is for the next 50 years, you'll get X amount of dollars every year. Most people say, well, I'd rather kill way more elephants, you know, this year and get a lot of money. And just, that's kind of human nature in terms of not being able to think about the future very well. So, go ahead.
I was going to say, which is why one needs a functioning community it's like, you know, Garrett Hardin's piece about Tragedy of the Commons, I always thought that was grossly misnamed. It should be the Tragedy of the Failure of the Commons, because for people who don't know it, it's basically if you have an area where everybody in the community gets to run 4 sheep and that can be done more or less forever, then if there's 10 different families, then one family might run 5 sheep and then 6 sheep and everybody will try to steal more. And then that's a tragedy, and that's why things should not be commons, so it's said. But the truth is that that's not how a commons works. A commons works by, if one person runs 5 sheep, everybody else in the community comes over to their house and says, this is not okay. And then if they do it again, then they burn down their house or something. You know, it's like, among the Dakota, if someone killed a bison out of season or killed a female bison when they're supposed to kill a male bison, they would, well, first off, it's unthinkable. But if they did it, they would burn their teepee, they would break their weapons, they would reduce them to beggary. And it's the same with the salmon on the Columbia, as you know, that there were hard-headed. It's not simply that the Indians had this cosmic spiritual relationship with salmon. They also had hard-headed policy agreements between the various nations as to who can take how many salmon and can do this into perpetuity. And those agreements, there are consequences for violating those agreements. And that's one of the problems with this whole big culture is, you know, you go back, somebody wrote a book a long time ago saying you should go forth and multiply, and then that book became a really big bestseller. You know, it's just this notion of, as you've said several times, this notion of growth is antithetical to A, sustainability, and B, community.
Well, I would agree with you on all those counts. And, the other problem with this approach, too, is that it tends to favor species that we see as being useful. That's one of the problems I have with the new environmentalism's approach is, you know, of conservation for human purposes. A lot of species are not really ones that most people particularly want to have around. For example, if you're raising cattle in the American West, you don't really want wolves around. But in our strictly protected areas like Yellowstone, well, we have wolves there. And wolves are allowed to function as they normally would, which is they sometimes kill things like elk that hunters outside of Yellowstone find intolerable. They don't want to share the elk with wolves. So one of the other problems with this whole community-based sustainable development kind of thing is it sort of favors species that have an economic value, and the many other species sort of fall through the net, so to speak, the holes in the net, and are not given protection. And whereas in a strictly protected area, if it's done properly, you're saying, well, we're going to have predators like wolves, and we're going to have we're going to protect the amphibians and the bees and the mosquitoes. We're not going to spray for mosquitoes or whatever, because we're going to assume that all these creatures have some role to play in ecosystem function, and we're not going to try to second guess which have important roles that we may be able to identify and which have important roles that we're just totally ignorant of. And you probably have heard the analogy about the jet plane where a person is sitting on the plane and somebody and looking out the window and somebody's there taking rivets off the wing to the point where they think the plane will still fly, but it's not as strong as it was because rivets have been taken out. And the idea, would you want to fly on that plane? And that's how it is with a lot of these ecosystems and species. We just do not know, and we'll never know which are playing important roles that we're unaware of. So the safe thing or the prudent thing is to, as many biologists say, is to protect everything to the degree that you can, realizing, of course, that, and this is another important argument that you hear, realizing, of course, that nothing is totally out of the reach, so to speak, of human influence, and that protecting a park or a wildlands is not done under the premise that this is totally pristine or totally unaffected by human footprint, but rather it's a sort of a degree of effect where a place like Yellowstone or the Arctic Wildlife Refuge is considerably less modified on a daily basis than some place like, you know, Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles, or Manhattan Island in New York. And so there are degrees of human influence and manipulation, and what you try to do in parks and wildlands is, to the degree possible, protect those areas from the excesses of humans' exploitation, and to realize that the most resilient landscapes are the ones that have are able to function with a minimum of human impact. And, you know, this is a necessity. When I hear this argument also from the apologists who think that humans should be controlling everything and gardening the world, but they say, well, you know, humans have always influenced and impacted these areas, but that, you know, that the impacts were much less, a much smaller degree, and had much less influence when we had low technology and low population. I mean, we can genetically modify now species genes. We could wipe out entire forests if we wanted to.
Well, we
that
have
capability. That capability means that we have to exercise greater restraint and self-control than maybe was necessary in the past. And then as you point out, we've lost some of those social constraints that worked also to limit, you know, excessive exploitation. And so it becomes even more important, in my view, then, to have strictly protected areas as the core for conservation strategy. It doesn't mean it's the only thing we should be doing, but that it should not be abandoned. And, you know, it's scary, but I read things today where some of the new environmentalists, not only do they say that parks and wildlands are passe and therefore, you know, have no role to play in conservation anymore, sometimes they actively argue against protected areas and getting rid of them. In parts of Brazil, for example, and Peru, there have been great reductions in some of these protected areas to downgrade them, I would say, to, you know, sustainable development areas or whatever you want to title you want to give them, sometimes led by people who identify themselves as environmentalists, which, of course, even if their motivation is good, in other words, I can understand trying to help poor people out, but what, you know, the fact is that most of the time the beneficiaries are the wealthy industries that have been waiting on the sidelines trying to get their hands on these resources, and, you know, oil companies and timber companies and rich ranchers and so forth. So their ability to when they downgrade it and make it, quote, sustainable development, usually that all that is facilitating corporate exploitation of one sort or another.
Oh, it's all a complete Trojan horse. It's the poor are being used just as the poor are often used under a capitalist system. And there's two things I want to say. One of them is that the first time I ever gave a talk that was interrupted by applause was in like 96 or 97 or something. It was a very short talk. It was a conference. And before me, there had been a philosopher. I just hate most philosophers except Kathleen Dean Moore. She's great. But anyway, most philosophers are terrible. Anyway, this guy was a terrible philosopher, and he's saying that basically because the arguments that you just were saying, that basically because humans have influenced the landscape forever, that basically means that anything goes, and that should be true today. And when it was my turn to give a talk, one of the things I said is that it is obscene to compare the Talawa, who have lived here for 12,500 years, that simply because they lived here forever with the salmon, that means it's okay for Boise Cascade and Potlatch and Weyerhaeuser to deforest. That's just completely obscene to mix those two. So that was one thing. It's crazy to say that simply because humans have lived in an area that means you can have industry in an area. It's just nuts. And then the other thing is, 15, 20 years ago, I asked Anuradha Mittal, former director of Food First, if the people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. And she laughed and said, of course. And so there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. And that's fine. But then I still always sort of wondered about, like, the people in Mumbai. You know, aren't they going to starve if – I mean, they need land. And so last fall I asked Vandana Shiva basically the same question. What about the people in the cities, the very, very poor? I don't care about the rich. They can – yeah, they're the problem. Anyway, the poor people in the cities. And she said, Derek, no, you get rid of the global economy – and there's instant land reform, because they've been forced off their land not by the tigers, not by the elephants. They've been forced off their land by Coca-Cola, by Monsanto. And so once again, all this is displacing the problem. It's like, well, I don't need to go on further. I mean, that's anyway, so sorry to go on so much and have my voice get thin and reedy, but this just makes me so angry that,
well,
go ahead.
Yeah, I want to respond to you. Just made me think of, well, part of what the chapter I wrote, Protecting the Wild, addresses sort of what you're just describing and the response you got, which is some of the new environmentalists say that the reason parks were made was to be able to round up indigenous people and put them on reservations. And they use Yellowstone as the first example, and I'm real familiar with Yellowstone's history. And it's just such a distortion. What was going on in the American West, of course, was, yes, indigenous people were being rounded up and put on reservations, but it wasn't so we could make national parks. It was so that we could go out and log and mine and farm and settle the landscape without having the competition or the fear of being attacked by the Indian tribes that lived there. And the whole idea that parks were made, at least the early parks in North America, by rounding up people to move them off the land so that we could make parks, is a real distortion. And even today, the degree that that happens is relatively minor compared to the movement of people for development. The Three Gorges Dam in China displaced millions of people. Show me one national park any place in the world that has displaced millions of people. Well, we think, at least some people think, nothing of taking people and moving them for highways, for using eminent domain in this country and in other places for things like dams and other development. So the point being is that, again, if you analyze this and look, you'll see that in the vast majority of places, when people are displaced or the resources are taken up to be exploited, that the beneficiaries are usually not the people who are living right there, and that it is done to expand the, the industrial exploitation of the landscape by people everywhere. And it just, to me, it's a red herring in a lot of cases and even in the places where there might be some limits, like we can go to marine areas, which our book doesn't address, but I've been reading about, and the places where they exclude fishing, the fish do a lot better, they grow bigger, there's more of them, and so forth. And it even benefits, to a degree, people that are living nearby, because the fish don't course stand. They're marine reserves entirely, and then they're available for exploitation nearby, which is better than having them all disappear, as in the tragedy of the commons you described.
Wait a second. Are you saying that if you have a place where fish don't get exploited, that they do better?
Yes, I'm saying that, yes.
That just seems so crazy to me.
No, they're bigger, they're more populous usually, there's more diversity, so forth, yeah.
So there's another question that seems to be at the heart of a lot of this, which is that I hate the word managing, but I'm going to use it, and we'll just put an asterisk on it, okay?
Okay.
So who can manage a forest better? A forest or industrial humans?
Well, my answer, of course, is I'm sure what you're fishing for is that the forest. And that is, this gets back to this infinite confidence in technology and knowledge. And I'm big on knowledge. I study ecosystems and ecology all the time. I find it very fascinating. But the thing that I have learned from studying ecology for 40 years now, Derek, is that it's what I've learned is how little we understand the world. And what it has done is it makes me even more cautious about saying we can do anything that alters the natural landscape and assume that, one, we're improving it. That to me is really arrogant, or enhancing it, or whatever the term might be, but that we're neutral even. I almost always go to meetings and I, with the Forest Service and other people, where they'll say, like I'll give you an example. There's mistletoe, which is a parasitic plant that will grow on trees around where I live, and the Forest Service feels like it needs to get rid of the mistletoe. Of course, their solution is always to log. And my first reaction, without knowing anything about the ecology of mistletoe, is what role does mistletoe play in the forest? I don't assume that it's a good idea to get rid of it. And yet that is sort of the common assumption of a lot of people, is that if there's something that seems to have an inconvenience or effect, in the case of mistletoe, the growth of trees, that that must be bad. And instead, I say, well, you know, here's why it might be good. Mistletoe might slow the growth of trees. Slower growing trees have stronger wood. The stronger wood doesn't rot as quickly. So when mistletoe infected trees die, they last longer in the ecosystem, which provides home for insects and small mammals longer, nutrients more slowly being returned to the environment. So mistletoe might have a benefit that way. And I'm just using that as conjecture, for example. But the point is that I don't assume that mistletoe is a bad thing for the forest. And what we have too much of is an assumption that we fully understand what is going on and what the consequences are to our actions. And if I've learned anything from studying ecology, it is that we almost never understand the consequences, and we almost never have the full picture. And that means a prudent thing to do is to have areas where we're not doing exploitation and have large areas. The thing that we call for, the old-fashioned types like myself, is that we should try to set aside 50% of the earth for a minimum of 50% for natural processes and wildlife, and that we ought to have large areas that are protected from human exploitation. And in places where there's been marginal exploitation over the years, we should get rid of those marginal activities and allow those areas to rewild and become again a self-managing or, as we say, self-willed landscape that has a minimum of human influence on it. It is not no influence, because we have things like global warming, we have, you know, global distribution of pesticides and so forth. We can't have it be totally pristine, but we can have a place that is less disturbed, less manipulated, and less compromised.
So we have like a minute left, and if you were made king of the United States, say, or more, you had a president and you had a Congress that would do what you wanted to. So you have some power. How would you begin to implement this? I know this is a lot to ask in now 45 seconds, but how would you begin to implement?
Well, I would say the first thing is the United States in particular is incredibly lucky in that we have about one-third of the United States is public domain. And most of that public domain could be set aside primarily as protected areas, not exploited areas. The amount of contribution, for example, grazing on public lands is 2-3% of the forage consumed by livestock in the country. If we eliminated livestock from all those public lands, it would basically have no impact. Even forestry, only something like 3-4% of the timber cut in this country comes off of the public lands. So there's an opportunity right from the start to get towards this 50% goal pretty quickly. Now, it's not evenly distributed because a lot of it's in the West and so forth. So, we'd have to be looking at that. But that would, I guess that's the first thing I would do, because if I were king and could control the direction here of the public lands, that's the way I'd push them.
Well, that's great. And thank you so much for your work. And let's do this again sometime. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.